Can I just ask a question? Put your hand up if the person that you are describing, and it springs to mind, and the setting is primarily a church setting or a workplace setting or a, you know, something out with church. If it was primarily something within church, raise a paw. Okay. If it was something out with church about somebody, or this was somebody that, you know, the main thing wasn't at church, it was somewhere else. Okay. Yeah. Okay. If it was both, you put two hands up. It probably was for me. Okay. So we're thinking about people who have made an impact on you because what was coming out and showing in from their lives it was visible. You spotted it. Maybe you saw characteristics that were godly consistently over a length of time. But clearly the fruit was there visibly in that person's life. And that's one of the key things that I want us to think about today, this evening, when we're looking at the bearing much fruit and modelling godly character and godly behaviour. So let's have a look at the Matthew passage. We need to bear in mind that what Jesus is doing when he teaches his disciples, the Sermon on the Mount is primarily directed towards his disciples. Of course, there were lots of other people, and you know, perhaps by the end of the Sermon on the Mount, they're all sitting there and listening as well. But Jesus sits down on the mountainside. His disciples came to him. He's withdrawn from the crowds. Notice he doesn't say in verse 1, when Jesus saw the crowds, he said to the disciples, come away with me and let's have a chat. When Jesus saw the crowds, he went away and sat down. And then his disciples, maybe they were looking for him, I don't know, there he is, went over and he began to teach them. Now, I want us to take that seriously because what Jesus is doing in the Sermon on the Mount is identifying how his disciples are going to be known as his. And there's a thing about this disciple term that is functioning here, which is very helpful for us when we think about ourselves as disciples. To be called a disciple and to be described by a teacher, Jesus known as a teacher, as a rabbi, Jesus the master, if you like, in this kind of master-disciple, master-pupil relationship. To be known as a disciple meant several things, and I've put them down here in this sort of first subheading. It meant that you were learning things. You were absorbing information, data, practices, procedures. You were learning stuff from your master, the one you were following, the one you were literally learning from. Disco, I learn. The one who was sort of adding a discipline to your life and a shape to your life. Now, we do that. We absorb information. We find out new things from the person who is our master when we're disciples. But it was always more than that. Your master was teaching you a way to think, not just things to think, but a way to think. Your master would teach you not just ways in which, you know, particular behaviors would work in a particular situation. He was teaching you just a way to be, so that wherever you went, you would take that with you. So you would learn data, so to speak. You would learn the law. You would learn the teacher's interpretation of the law. You would learn the previous interpretations of the law that were given that your particular rabbi, teacher, master would favor. You would learn something that belonged to the school of that master's teaching. And there were two major competing ones around the time when Jesus was teaching in his ministry. So you would learn the material in the way that you would learn from a lecturer at university or from a teacher at school. But you would just learn a way to live as well. And the way you did that was you were with the person basically 24/7. A master, a teacher, a rabbi would not have many people who were known as disciples. There will be, you know, lots of people who would come and listen to him lecture. There will be lots of people who would follow them. They would be popular. They were, in some respects, celebrities in their day. But there was only a few who could be his disciples from the very simple practical point of view that the disciple basically lived with the master. So would share the home, would share meals. So it was a kind of 24/7 thing. It wasn't that they would just go to lectures and go away and never get to know the person. Getting to know the person was the thing. And that only happened with a lot of contact. So, you know, there you are, you're a teacher, and all your class go home with you. And they watch you preparing food, and they do it with you, and they just muck in, and, you know, it's 24/7. Which is why the master-pupil, the master-teacher-disciple relationship was almost a familial, almost a father-son kind of relationship. And that was the way in which you simply didn't learn material, gather information. It's the way in which they shaped your lives. Because you just began to do things the way they did things. And that was the whole point of being with them all the time. It was, therefore, an enormous privilege. If you were selected to be a disciple of a rabbi, a teacher, a master, that was an enormous privilege. You counted it as a huge privilege. Because your rabbi, teacher, master was someone that you respected enormously. And for them to say, I want you to be one of my disciples, for them to turn to you and say, follow me, i.e. walk my way, that was an enormous privilege. It wasn't to be counted lightly at all. And the whole social environment meant that you would never treat that privilege lightly. You would never cast that off. It was just the most wonderful thing to be asked. And what Jesus is doing here is he said the follow me stuff. He's now teaching them what it will mean for them to do what? To do what every master is supposed to do with respect to the rabbi, that is to become like them. And it was just one of the things that was an accepted part of society, that you could tell whose disciples people were by watching them. You just look at them and you knew. Their speech, maybe sometimes the way they styled their appearance, but mostly their speech, their manner, the things they would do and wouldn't do, mark them out. And so they will be Rabbi Hillel's disciples. And they will be identified as being very close to him. And, you know, as it says here, you can tell who their master is just by looking at them. Now, when Jesus says, follow me, he is not simply saying, come and walk my way and learn my stuff and come and be with me all the time, which they were. He was picking them to be his shop window. He was picking them to do what? To do what he was doing. Here is Jesus, as Paul writes in to the Colossians that we learned that we were looking at the other Sunday, the image of the invisible God. That is, the visible thing that lets us see what the invisible is like. So the disciples were not just absorbing all this from Jesus. Jesus expected that they, by the way they were, would let everybody else know what he was like. So right from the word go, when we've got discipleship in the New Testament, it's exactly the thing that we're talking about in this series, in Fruitfulness on the Frontline. And it's exactly the thing that this whole Fruitfulness on the Frontline thing about, it's the thing which fruitfulness is helping us to get into our not just into our heads, but into our whole lives. That is the whole life, disciple-making disciple. So that's what it meant to be a disciple. You were with your master all the time. Everything you did spoke about him. And by the way you lived, others would want to follow him. And his teaching will be commended. His lifestyle, his life will be commended. So what he does here is saying, look, if you're following me, or since you're following me, you need to be like this. And that's how people will know. And of course, that's the logic, isn't it, of the 11th commandment. You know, new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you. So your love for one another bears the same image as my love for you. You become, you know, image bearers of me. By this will all men know that you are my disciples. Because in those days, you could be a disciple of several people. There were lots of options. So when people saw these characteristics, then they would know that those men were not disciples of Rabbi Hillel or any of the others. But in fact, they were disciples of Jesus, because that's what Jesus was like. So rather like the list of that ninefold fruit that we have in Galatians, we've got here a character list of Jesus. It's the same sort of thing. We've got here the godliness, which is the evidence that you've been learning from Jesus. You've got here the image of Jesus that's been carried around. And so we get these character traits. Now, second red heading there. If you say it wrong, it comes out as red herring. Now, I've said 8. It's debatable whether verse 10 is number 8 and verse 11 is number 9. But I think they belong together. It's all one beatitude, because I think 11 just fills out what is said in short compass in verse 10, by way of a bit of a sort of a warning that's what's going to happen. So here are these 8 character traits. We'll take it. Now, this is what disciples of Jesus look like, because this is what Jesus look like. Blessed are the poor in spirit. That is, blessed are those who know their need of God. It's poor in spirit. It's not poor in financial terms or anything like that. It bears no relation whatsoever to your material wealth or poverty. It is something in your spirit which knows its need of God. It's nothing to do with, like, you know, meanness or faintness or whatever. It is a God reference thing. You know that anything good in you is coming from God, not from yourself. You know that you don't have the strength of spirit to resist temptation yourself. You need God. You know that you are an empty vessel, and only God can fill you. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. So when we are broken, when we are bereft, and we know that mourning is something that can happen to us in many different situations, as well as the death of a loved one. For they will be comforted, strengthened. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Meek is not sort of, you know, weak, fawning, sort of doormat stuff. As we've said before, the old saying, if you think it's weak to be meek, try being meek for a week. It is not pushing yourself to the front all the time. It's letting other people go first through the door. Not because you're just well-mannered and you were brought up properly to say please and thank you and say after you, thus creating the slowest thing on four legs, which is two Christians trying to get through a door. It's because you genuinely don't want to be seen to be, because you don't want actually to be the kind of person who's just always pushing themselves and thinking of themselves So it corresponds with what Paul writes to the church in Philippi when he says every man ought to think of other people's needs more, not to think more highly of himself, but prefer others. You just other people first. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Now that's interesting, isn't it? Because it doesn't mean blessed are those who know they need to be righteous. We all do. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. It's like a physical ache. You've got to have it. You know you haven't got it. You've got to have it. They will be filled. Blessed are the merciful. And we know that the idea of mercy is a very rich one. It's got kindness in there and generosity of spirit and a responsiveness to the needs of people around us. It is not a feeling alone. It is a feeling which issues in action and has to do with what we might call loving kindness. It's you see people in need. You've got love in your heart. It goes out to them and you do the kind thing. Blessed are the poor in heart, the pure in heart, for they will see God. The heart, of course, as we keep saying in the New Testament, is the seat of the will. It's what moves you. It's what the Puritans kept calling the affections, what stirs you, what motivates you to do things and why you do this and not that. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. That is, those who carry the likeness of God, who is a peacemaker. You know, just think of how God was in Christ reconciling us to himself as Christ made peace through the cross. See, Jesus' idea of peacemaking is based on himself. Jesus' idea of peacemaking involves a cross. Jesus' idea of peacemaking involves reconciling people, not just stopping a war or a fight. And then, finally, blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness. When people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you. We all know how words can wound us when they've got this false things being said. Rejoice and be glad. Now, those are the character traits. And of course, Jesus is not here describing eight different people. As if, you know, you might, by natural disposition, be a bit shy, take that as being meek, which it isn't anyway, and think, okay, I'm really good at being meek. I can do that. I've been able to do that since I was a child. So I've got the meek thing. I don't need to work too hard on the others. Because he's describing a disciple. And what does a disciple do? A disciple learns a whole way of life, a whole way to think, a whole way to be, so that others can see it. So it's not a fat lot of use, is it? If people see us being merciful, but then we're telling stories that demonstrate that we're absolutely riddled with lusts and indulgence, and we're not pure in heart. And what does that say about Jesus? So it's they all work together. This is the roundedness of the Christian character. This is the roundedness of a godly character. So that what we model when we do a bit of something which displays, models godliness, that sets it before people, what we do has a consistency. We are all of a piece. So that people don't get any nasty surprises. So we're peacemakers, yes. And we also can take some persecution without giving up and taking our bat home, so to speak. So here are eight characteristics, eight character traits. They all work together. Here are eight ways in which a godliness that we've got will show itself, in which we will be able to model godliness. Now, what I want us to notice, though, is what I've called the characteristic validation. What on earth does that mean? Where does the disciple get their sense of being validated in what they're doing? Where do you, as a Christian, get your sense of being validated, affirmed? Where do you get the well done from? Where do you get, as a Christian, the thing that tells you that you're doing the right thing, you're doing the acceptable thing? Now, in normal discipleship terms, that came from two places. It came from the master, so you would want the master to say, well done, good and faithful disciple. But it came from the public round about you. So there was an awful lot of kudos about being a disciple of Hillel or whoever it was. It was, you know, feather in your cap. There's a lot of public kudos, and you got validation, as it were, from that. You got that reinforcement. You got that thing that, you know, call it affirmation, encouragement, validation, whatever. The thing that made you feel you'd done well would come from your master, teacher, rabbi, and from a general public social thing. But where does the disciple of Jesus get their validation? Where do you get the well done? Where do you get the thing that, you know, puts a smile on your face because you know you've done the right thing? Where do you get that from if you're a disciple of Jesus? You get it from Jesus, and you get it from the Father, not from people around. So even if people around don't smile and say, hey, well done, that was a really nice thing you did, even if they insult you for doing the right thing, being the right person, being like Jesus. And Jesus in John, of course, 15 and 16, said they will do that. They'll hate you for it. If people persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me, because you're being righteous, then what do you do? Well, at that moment, you find out whether you're really a disciple of Jesus or not. Because you find out where you get your validation from. And the disciple of Jesus gets it all from God. So you're not going to get an earthly kingdom, but you will get a heavenly kingdom. You won't be ruled under earth because you're playing its games and playing according to its rules. But you will live under the rule of Jesus Christ, and it lasts forever. And you might be despised and avoided when you mourn, but there will be comfort that comes to you. And it comes to you from God. And so you go through. And inherit the earth is a reference to new creation, by the way. It's not, which American was it? Was it Rockefeller who said, blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth, but I'm going to get the mining rights or the mineral rights or something like that. One of them. It's the new earth that is part of the new creation that Jesus is speaking about there. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. See, all the validation is to do with Jesus and the Father. All the validation is ahead. All the validation has to do with what, again, if we can sort of cross-reference, Paul writes about in 2 Corinthians 4 when he says, so we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. And he talks about that far more exceeding an eternal weight of glory that far outweighs our light and momentary afflictions when you're getting squeezed by the world, flipsis, squeezed in between a rock and a hard place. So where do you get your validation? The characteristic of a disciple of Jesus is that we get our validation, our well done, our affirmation, our encouragement from Jesus and the Father and the future that they have for us. Even though it may mean that we receive insults, persecution, and false accusations, and look what it says, not falsely use evil words, i.e. bad language or something, but falsely say all kinds of evil against you. That is, you have evil heaped on you. And you're accused of evil. And your good will be described as bad because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Just maybe have in mind Hebrews 11 and the heroes of faith, of whom this world was not good enough. So, that character shows. So, Jesus says that his disciples are the light of the world. They can't be hidden. They're like a lamp that's not put under a bowl, but put on a stand that gives light to everyone in his house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. So we model godly behavior. We model godliness, godly character, so that, not so that other people around us, whether it's in church or elsewhere, say, well done and all the rest of it. They may, but they may not. They may not even notice. That doesn't matter. God notices. We're doing it for him. Even if nobody else sees the thing, you know, like even if sometimes part of our godliness is like those flowers that bloom in the desert after a rain shower, nobody on the planet sees them, but God does. And they're a delight to him. Okay, but it's got to be visible. That's the whole point. As Jesus bore the image of the invisible God, so we bear his image. So that people can tell who our master is just by looking at us. It shines before men, not so that we can feel good about ourselves, but so that the Father is glorified, which is why Jesus lived the way he lived. I have brought you glory on earth, he was able to say in John 17. I have glorified you. And we know that in Philippians 2, 6 to 11, that great hymn about Christ losing everything and then gaining everything, so that every knee will bow and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of the Father. And we know that our fruit bearing, again, John 15, 8, is to the glory of the Father. That's why we let our light shine before men. It's not because we're extroverts. It's not because we're showing off. It's not because we want their praise or anything. We're probably not going to get it. It's not so that people will think how nice we are and then liking us will become Christians. It often does not work like that. It is so that God might be glorified. So there's no kind of private world. There's no shyness in this, although sometimes some of us are shy. I'm not talking about you suddenly become extrovert. I mean, you can't hide this. There's no false modesty about this. It needs to be seen, and the way it gets seen is not by us trumpeting ourselves and, you know, walking into work or something one day and saying, hey, I've just done a really wonderful thing on the way to work here. And so the lady had fallen on the ice and I just did everything, absolutely everything for her. And she's not only now in hospital, but I cleared the pavement for everybody else. It's not that sort of stuff that is shining. It's talking about being engaged with people. Being in the same room, being engaged with their lives so that they experience godliness from you. So that they experience kindness when you get them a cup of tea as well as getting yourself one. So that they experience kindness when you hold the door open for them. So that they experience what it would be like if Jesus was in the room, if Jesus was on their team at work, if Jesus was a teacher at their school, if Jesus worked in wherever, if Jesus was their neighbor, that's what they experience, because you're engaged, not separated. So where does all this come from? Well, the key to this is verse 20. Jesus says, for I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. How? You know, these people are now following Jesus. The righteousness of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law was legendary because their righteousness consisted of their ability to protect with little rules God's Ten Commandments. Their righteousness consisted of their ability to tick more boxes than you would even know about. Their righteousness was an external conformity to an external code. So when Jesus says, I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, if you think that righteousness is what they thought it was, then you're going to be thinking to yourself, right, I'm going to have to get some more rules now. I'm going to have to add more. And 522 isn't enough. We better add some more on there. And my word, I could easily begin to think of that, actually. I could get some more rules that might stop me breaking that one, although I might break some of those. So I better have some more rules hedging those around about. They talk about the hedge to stop you falling, you know, sort of breaking the big ones. So you get it's multiplication of laws. That is the practice of those who haven't a clue how to create good behavior naturally. And it's the practice of governments when their wheels are spinning to multiply laws, as if that's actually going to change anybody. And then, of course, they get broken, so you have to multiply them more. Their righteousness was going to surpass that of the Pharisees and teachers of the law. Their righteousness was going to be the righteousness that belongs truly to the kingdom of heaven, because their righteousness was going to have to come from inside. It requires a change of heart. It requires the work of God within. Now, Jesus is not talking here about what we sometimes call imputed righteousness. He's talking about what we sometimes have called imparted righteousness. That is the very righteousness of God in you. In Henry Scougal, Aberdeen clergyman, founder of Christian Unions, Puritan wrote, it is the life of God in the soul of man. Or as we were saying on Sunday morning, you've got God in you. Or if we just shift the emphasis, you've got God in you, who is righteous. So if Jesus' disciples were going to keep God out and try and do it all themselves, they were stuffed. They would never get it. They just missed the whole point of it. It isn't that they wouldn't be able to keep enough rules. That wasn't what it was about. They just would not become righteous in the way that Jesus was righteous, from the inside out. So that in whatever circumstance you're in, the character of the Master shows. And you can move freely and easily through different social contexts with different kinds of people over a long period of life, and you will be the same person. You'll be a Christian. You'll be a follower of Jesus. So it's got to come from the inside out, unlike the disciples of the other rabbis who spent half their lives learning the rule book and the other half of their lives breaking the rules. So, more godliness modeled, more characteristics for us to think about, for us to sort of look for, more about where it comes from, and we hope and pray, because, you know, it's not just another topic out of a year, two, three, four, five different years full of different topics. We hope and pray that our lives do this, that they bear this kind of fruit, as well as the other five that we'll be looking at. So here are the remaining questions that you've got. Describe examples of godly behavior that have impressed you, not necessarily maybe a key person in your life from that first question, but describe examples of godly behavior that have impressed you. What situations in a normal day test your godliness? And what instances, for many of us, driving is a constant test of our godliness. What instances have you seen in your own life that tell you that the Spirit is, in fact, at work in you? One of the ways of understanding fruit of the Spirit is to replace the word fruit with evidence, because that's part of the thinking, that what's on the inside shows on the outside by virtue of the fruit. You know what kind of fruit, what kind of tree it is by looking at the fruit. And by their fruits you shall know them. That is, your fruit is evidence of your species and variety. So it's an evidence, it's an outward, visible evidence of what's on the inside. This isn't bragging or anything, this is just simply for our encouragement. What evidence have we seen that actually the Spirit is at work in our lives? How can we glorify God by saying, yes, Lord, in that situation, you didn't just help me to do that, you actually helped me to want to do that, both to will and to do of your good pleasure. So, these three questions left, 2, 3, and 4. I suggest for this that we just break into a few groups of maybe 4 people. If it gets more than 4, then it becomes difficult to go through these, and it also might become difficult to hear what somebody is saying, that sort of 200 yards over the other side of things. So keep it to 4, and I don't know how that's going to work out with the numbers, but if you put it in groups of 4 and work on questions 2, 3, and 4, and then we'll pray at the end.